Welcome to Coaching Uncaged by Animas, the podcast that explores the art, science, and career of coaching. And now, introducing your host and interviewer, Yannick Jacob.
All right. Simon Weston, welcome back to the podcast, an old friend.
Nice to see you again, Yannick. Very good to be here.
Well, I say old friend, not because we are old friends and we go way back, but it feels like we go way back, at least as far as this podcast is concerned. And actually, you go beyond my times even. You've been on the podcast before I hosted it. So really good to have you back. For those of you who don't know Simon, you do so many things, right? You're CEO of Analytic Network Coaching, where you also run trainings that both my previous host here from the podcast, Rob, has done, and also my wife has done. So there's really quality training that you offer, offering a psychoanalytic approach to working with coaching clients, taking network systemic elements into play. So really quality stuff. You're the founder of the Eco Leadership Institute. You used to be an adjunct professor at the University College of Dublin. Couple of other things that you've done psychoanalytically, right? You're the former president of the ISPSO, which I have to look at, the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. So really, how can we use psychoanalysis on psychoanalytic approaches to work in organizations? And you're also the former director of Masters in Organizational Consultancy, where you use psychoanalytic approaches at Tavistock Clinic, I'm sure many of our audience here know. And I must mention your two excellent textbooks, which is Leadership, a Critical Text, and Coaching and Mentoring, a Critical Text. Everywhere I look, you offer this critical perspective, and critical in the most positive sense of the word, really thinking a couple of levels deeper and inviting other people to do so. Your podcast, Edgy Ideas, does that beautifully for people who like to listen to more of you. So there's a lot out there, and there's a depth to your thinking that I really appreciate. So thank you for making the time again.
Real pleasure. Thanks for the introduction.
So, where do we start? We have a huge topic on our hands. As people will may or may not know by now, we are exploring in this season the underlying foundations of coaching. What does coaching stand on? And psychoanalytic approaches, they feature strongly both in your bio and in your work. So I would love to start with just maybe drawing out the landscape, the range of what psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic approaches mean. There's different facets, different strands. Could you talk a little bit about what are we talking about when we mean psychoanalytic approaches?
Yes, thanks, Yannick. Psychoanalysis is a practice going back to Freud, as we know, and it was a real breakthrough. I mean, it was a real game changer in terms of how people thought about mental illness, neurosis, kind of anxiety. It is foundational and fundamental work, and Freud kind of brought the idea in that we're doubly subjected, that we're not just rational beings wandering the earth. We actually have a subjection to our conscious and another subjection to our unconscious, and this is really known. I mean, if you go before Freud, we look at different novels, different authors, different thinkers. You know, this was known, but it was never named quite so clearly, and it was never explored in quite the same way. So Freud kind of identified this very clearly, and then he got patients on the couch. So he didn't kind of plan this way of working. He found this way of working emergently. So he was experimenting. He invented what was called by one of the early patients the talking cure. And for me, this is the link to coaching. This talking cure goes back to Freud, where you actually, rather than treat people physically or with some technical treatment, you listen to them, and you listen very carefully. And Freud learned to listen to the conscious and the unconscious, and he learned that patients projected things onto him. He kind of learned, he didn't kind of come up with this idea, he just observed the data, and he realized that some patients would turn him into kind of a good daddy, some would turn him into a bad daddy, some people would turn him into different things. There's too much anger, and he couldn't make sense of it. And he started to develop the concept of transference and counter-transference and all his ideas. And Freud was just phenomenal. He kind of wrote really, really widely. And people often kind of go back and they critique Freud as being outdated and I think what they don't realize was Freud was a real pioneer, and he was always questioning his own theories, always adapting them. And I'm sure if he was kind of projected 100 years into the future, he'd be saying something quite different. But he was one of those very, very deep thinkers. And that's the kind of foundations, because coaching is part of this family of the talking cure.
There's a couple of elements in there that I'd love to go a little bit deeper in. First of all, the talking cure, right? There's a word cure in there.
Yeah.
And that kind of draws out some possibly differences between coaching and therapy, right? Because we're not necessarily curing clients through coaching, but there's a curing element in there, right? Could you talk a bit more about what you mean by cure, what Freud meant?
Yeah, I mean, again, it wasn't Freud who said it was one of his patients, but it was, she also is the same woman who was undergoing treatment with, I think it's Brewer, one of his colleagues, talked about chimney sweeping. Like she felt that when she talked, that things she cleansed herself, she got rid of some neurotic, anxiety provoking feelings, and you know, this is very commonplace today. We, you know, talk about your feelings, don't bottle them up. It's kind of the same thing, and coaching is part of that. The talking cure, don't get fixated on cure. I mean, we people come to coaching not for kind of a cure, but they do come to kind of work on something, work on challenges. So the way of working through talking is kind of is a focus, and coaching, like psychoanalysis, is very diverse, as you know. So some coaches are very technical driven, very kind of performative, very behaviorist. Others are kind of much more open about the way they work. Some are systemic. So coaching is this broad thing, but what holds it together at the center is this idea of talking and listening.
I love the metaphor of chimney sweeping. It's developing very richly in my mind right now, because what I'm picturing is there's often a kind of a dark, deep, maybe not hole, but like a channel that many people don't seem to enter. I mean, I'm quite reflective by, maybe not by nature, but like I think about stuff and I enjoy thinking about stuff. Many of my coaching clients, it seems, that don't enjoy that so much, or they don't have the time to do that so much. So as you start reflecting and exploring, often very quickly, it goes to a level of depth, and it can feel dark and kind of maybe a bit dirty, and there's stuff coming out, and it can kind of put a layer of dirt into your living room for a while, and it can feel a bit uncomfortable. Right. Stuff comes out when you kind of go to these places.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you raising the question about the cure is important, because one way I personally use psychoanalysis has changed. So a lot of psychoanalysis actually does focus on, a lot of therapy does focus on what I would call pathology. So thinking about the wounded self. In my books, I talk about the wounded and the celebrated self. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work is focused on the wounded self, you know, tell me what your problem is, and trying to kind of work through your problems and your challenges and your hurt and all the damaged side of the self, the shadow side of the self. This language is very common. And I think that the psychoanalysis is too fixated on that. I think therapy gets too fixated on that. And when coaching came along in my life, I loved it, because it allowed me to kind of work with a different energy as well, which was a more positive energy. So I'm very happy to go deep with someone on the shadow side, on the challenges. A lot of coaches aren't, but I think that's important to allow people to go to those places if they want to, if they need to. Mm-hmm. But also balance that with, like, you know, let's look at the resilience. Let's look at the good things in your life. Let's look at the kind of the power you have. Let's not just kind of put you in this victim position and me be the expert therapist who kind of solves your problems. Let's kind of make this more equal and let's transform this. So I actually bring in a Lacanian psychoanalytic view, which we'll talk about a bit later, to try and balance this kind of like healing wounded self side with something more positive. And coaching allows us to do that, I think, very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wish more people would go see a therapist or an analyst who are pretty resourceful and don't really feel they have this wounded self. They have these big wounds, these things that need to be addressed. Otherwise, they can't really function. Most people, unfortunately, I think, wait until something really painful comes up before they go on that kind of journey. And anybody can go on that journey. So I think from that position, if somebody goes to an analyst or a therapist, you know, who just wants to go on a deep exploration of self, well, stuff might come up that is uncomfortable or difficult or challenging, but they're coming in from a position of, you know, being quite resourced.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, I go on the couch every few years, so it's sort of important part of my work. It's developmental, like you say, rather than it's not because I'm terribly suffering of a certain thing. It's because I want to continue to develop myself, to continue to get insights into how I'm working and what's going on for me and surface some unconscious things. You know, it's just a very helpful kind of way of working. It really helps me then in my consultancy and coaching work.
Yeah. So if somebody who like that is quite resourced, just wants to go on that sort of journey, where then is the difference between coaching and psychoanalysis?
I mean, there's many differences, you know. So psychoanalysis is a clinical practice. Traditional psychoanalysis is very strict, a 15-minute hour. You kind of come in, you have a very contained environment. You meet an analyst who's usually quite silent and allows you to free associate into the space, and they'll interpret it, make some interpretations about what you say. So it's a kind of a different environment to work and thinking. Coaching is, I mean, I work in workplace coaching, so I think that's a differentiate, an important thing to say as well. So I don't go into life coaching, and yet most of my clients talk about very personal things. So coaching for me was very interesting. When I started coaching, I was at Lancaster Business School, Management School, and I was working with senior executives. And I kind of thought I must switch, because I'm a family therapist, I'm a trained therapist. I thought I must switch into this new way of working and be more focused on their strategy, on what they're doing. And in my coaching book, I write about the coaching confessional. It was really funny because I'm probably quite good at holding spaces, and I kind of I have a presence in the coaching environment. I hold an open space, and the client talks into that space, and it's quite interesting. And they talk into it. They confess something, not like a church confessional, but they say something quite personal and quite private about actually how they're not so happy in their job or their marriage or something's going on for them, which is kind of troubling them, you know. And they speak that into the space, and I was really quite surprised, like, wow. And I realized that the overlap between psychoanalysis and coaching is that if you hold open a space, the human being opposite you talks into that space. And quite often they talk into it. What they say into that space surprises them. It's almost like they're listening to themselves. Something comes out of their bodies and speaks into that space, which actually surprises the client as well. They don't plan to say anything, but something arises because you've held that space. And in our busy workplaces and in our busy lives, people don't get a chance to sit and just be. And when you get a chance to sit and be, something arises within you.
Yeah, especially if you have eager coaches, you know, wanting to help and disrupt and accelerate. It can be counterintuitive to really just be there and hold space for someone to show up.
And, you know, when I'm training coaches, a lot of my work is to get coaches to pause, to hesitate, to kind of listen in a different way. You know, don't be listening to the content all the time, just a story. You know, listen to how the body is speaking, listen to what's happening in your own body. You know, this is how psychoanalysis influences my coaching work.
Yeah, this is what my wife often says, who's trained as a Lacanian psychoanalyst. She talks about forming as an analyst, meaning to train your ear to listen in a different way.
Yeah.
And it seems difficult to describe what it is, the way that you are listening. How would you describe what's special about a psycholytic way of listening and engaging?
There's a couple of things. I mean, one is you're listening to your own body speak to you, and you're listening to your own unconscious. So you're not just kind of trying to dig deep into the patient's or the client's unconscious. You're not trying to sort of excavate, you know. I mean, people have an idea of this pyramid with the unconscious at the bottom, and you dig away until you find some deep hidden truth or hidden kind of anxiety. It's not like that. You're actually in relationship with, and the unconscious is between you. So you actually kind of are listening to your own body, and you're thinking, why am I uncomfortable now? Where does that anxiety suddenly come from? Wow, I'm feeling angry at the moment. And this is what we call countertransference. You know, you're trying to make sense of kind of what's happening between you and the client. What's going on there? So you're listening to their words. Clearly, you follow their words carefully. You're listening to kind of slips in their words. You're listening to how the unconscious can slip through their language. You know, the way they use language. Language is very important in Lacanian work, you know. So you listen for slips. and you're observing kind of their body language and your own. So the body is really important in Lacanian psychoanalysis. You know, we don't think of the unconscious just as something in your brain, some kind of cognitive thing. It's actually carried in our bodies, in the way we sit, in the way we hold ourselves, in the way our voice changes. So you're listening to all these things, and you're listening to yourself as well as the other.
Yeah. I wonder how to deepen that, right? Because there's a lot of doors open now. You talk about the unconscious, and I wonder, maybe perhaps for the listener who's heard the term but maybe not really familiar or aware in what that means and how it shows up, could we take a few steps back and just kind of what is that? And maybe I'll let me throw in, because we talked to Dr. Lawrence Barrett, who I'm sure you're familiar with, a Jungian coach, a couple of episodes ago. And I know there's some different perspectives on the unconscious. Yeah. And Jung and Freud at some point went separate ways. So could you talk a little bit about the unconscious, maybe different perspectives or your perspective on it?
Yeah, I'll talk about my perspective. I mean, there's... It's interesting, the psychoanalytic community, a bit like kind of other communities, are always splitting. It's like from the Freud Jung split, they're always arguing over the narcissism of small differences, as Freud called it. You know, so I find it a bit tiresome. And then they split over doctrines and dogma and ways of working, methods. You know, what is the unconscious? The question, what is the unconscious, is very alive today. Like, people have very different ideas of what it is, and different traditions pick up different things. And now there's a great interest in neuroscience, which some people claim has proven there is an unconscious. You know, so there's all this kind of mix up there, you know. So let me just talk about how I understand it. I mean, I understand that this idea that we're doubly subjected, that there's always like a conscious knowledge of what's happening around us, and there's always something else. And it's just something else I'm interested in. So, you know, I'm kind of amused by my own unconscious. You know, I find it a playful thing to be with. So, you know, when I forget my keys, when I don't want to go for a meeting, you know, it's classic. It's like, here we go again. You know, it's almost like you've got a kind of a friend, a subversive friend with you, you know, kind of like makes you lose something because you're anxious about leaving the house. You know, it's very present in between, in relation to people. So again, I don't think of it just like as Simon's unconscious is working away. I think too many people get fixated on kind of this individualism. For me, the unconscious kind of is between people, and actually works at a collective level as well. So in society, there's group fears and group anxieties, which some are expressed, some are clear, and some are not. You know, so when you hear people get very worried about immigration and boats coming in and stuff, you know, beneath that is some unconscious fear, some unconscious anxiety. And understanding that unconscious anxiety, unconscious fear, is important, because you won't solve it if you just kind of try and address the initial issue. And it's the same with clients, and the same with my own life. You know, let's try and work beneath the surface a little bit with this kind of what else is going on. And it helps us kind of understand change. So working in a coaching environment, this is kind of quite huge, because rather than just kind of say, set your goal, set your target, how can we get there? You're asking a very different question. I mean, I'm asking people kind of, what is your symptom? What are you circling around again and again in a repetitive way, which holds you in a challenging relationship or in a dysfunctional way, or is powerful for you? It gives you a lot of power. You know, it can be a positive thing as well, but it's a different question to say what is your symptom.
Yeah, what is your symptom? I know another question you like to ask is, what is your desire?
Yeah, I often start a coaching session with that question, and it immediately disrupts a comfortable chat, you know. And it's a very good question, because it makes people think, and they usually come back. I say, you know, okay, so welcome to this coaching session. I'd like to start off by asking you, you know, what is your desire? What are you here for? And they look at me, wow, what's this guy saying? What do you mean, what is my desire? You know, and I hold my silence. And it's really, really quite interesting, because people then start to think, you know, yeah, what is my desire? I haven't asked that question for a long time. I've been like busily kind of trying to get promotion and running my life for the last decade. And I've never stopped to think about, you know, what is my true desire? What am I about? You know, and it just sets off the coaching in a way where people say, this is interesting work.
Yeah, it's questions you usually don't hear so much.
And it engages people.
Yeah, exactly. And engages them on another level. Like you said, it kind of disrupts their usual system. What are some other ways, maybe from your coaching work or, you know, something you've picked up on? And how can we access the unconscious? A lot of coaches talk about making the unconscious conscious.
Yeah.
But I think often that still remains at the surface level. So what do you do with a client, or what are some of those stories where you found access to that level?
I mean, I talk a lot about in my training about taking up a third position. So you're actually engaged with the person you're coaching, and you're also kind of sat in a third position, observing them both, like you're observing yourself and the other, and you're thinking, what are these two getting caught up in?
Hmm.
Yeah. Why do they repeat kind of this kind of cozy conversation, or why do they kind of get really stuck on this point? So you're kind of trying to pick up kind of what's going on dynamically, psychodynamically, as well as just the content. So, you know, what are the psychodynamics going on? Is there a power play here? You know, this chief executive I'm coaching keeps on trying to take over the session and drive it in this direction, you know, and I won't kind of react to that in a way of like, I've got to kind of hold my own against them, or it's like, that's interesting. You become curious, you know, you take up a curious position. And I make this unconscious conscious. So I will say, I was speaking to him, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to someone recently, and I said, it's interesting. We're in this conversation, and you're spending 70% of the time talking, and I'm spending 30% of the time talking. And I'm wondering what that's about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and it kind of cuts right across the content. And they start thinking about why they need to dominate the situation, what they're anxious about, why they feel the need to be in control, what they're afraid I might say, why they're silencing me, and all those dynamics. And you explore that, and that's the unconscious work being done. That's the kind of the unconscious being made conscious. So you name the kind of process of dynamics as well as the content dynamics.
Yeah. It brings supervision to mind as well, that kind of viewing from the balcony, viewing the dance that you're in, the relationship dynamics that are showing up, taking a helicopter perspective, taking a step back. There's many, many words for it, but like really moving away from the actual content that is spoken and focusing on the dynamics, focusing on what's underneath, getting curious about that really shifts a conversation.
It's just a conversation, and the client suddenly comes alive. Quite often you'll be in sessions and you'll be getting bored. You know, both of you will be getting bored with your own conversation. You'll be getting kind of a bit stuck and a bit sleepy, you know. And it's usually because you're not doing any kind of serious work.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually a sign, you know, boredom for me is always a trigger, like, okay, we need to do some work. Now, it's not because the person's boring. It's because we're not really touching something which is important to them. And the minute you kind of make an intervention like that, the session comes alive again. And it's very interesting, a different energy.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder, what are some other psychoanalytic concepts or dynamics? Because what I find is the language very often is in the way of coaches being able to understand it, dig into it, utilize it. So I wonder if you could shed some light on some of these big words that actually show up in relatively simple and tangible ways.
Yeah, and I think... it's important to do that. So my work is very, very pragmatic. You know, I work with people in car factories. I work with people in banks. You know, these people have kind of serious jobs and then they need serious help. So we don't go off into some kind of esoteric journey. You know, this psychoanalytic approach really helps the work we do. So I work with concepts like lack. It's a Lacanian concept, which is really to think about what's not being said, because what's not being said, what's missing, the gap, we talk about minding the gap, the gap points to the real. So the gap points to the symptom. This way of thinking, you're in a session and you're kind of listening and you're realizing that something's missing. You're realizing that there's something missing. And you ask a client, you know, there's something missing in this conversation. You know, there's something not being said. There's something I'm experiencing, this is from my experience, I think there's something kind of not happening here. And you go into this kind of reflective mode, and This really helps us because lack points to desire. So this original question, what is your desire? As you're working through the sessions, you start kind of seeing patterns of lack, patterns of gaps. And you realize that lack points to desire. If you think about this, you know, lack, if you don't have something, you want it. You know, often if you, you know, if you're prohibited not to have something, if there's a law, you can't have this, you kind of, it makes it more desirable, you know. So to transgress the law of the father is to kind of what is to want something. So people often desire things, but the question about lack and desire, lack points to desire. Lack always kind of leads to the desire. It's like but a hidden desire, an unconscious desire. So we have a conscious desire. We want a new car. We want promotion. We want a happy family. This is all kind of, we know some of our desires, you know. But beneath that, it's like, what shapes those desires? Mm-hmm. And Lacan has this idea that our desires is always the desire of the other. And this is interesting because the desire of the other might mean you're actually following a path which your parents set for you, or an influential other set for you. Now, your parents always wanted you to be a doctor, and you kind of, you either kind of carried on, became a doctor, or you rebelled against your parents and became a cleaner or a teacher or something. But even though you rebelled, you're still reacting to the desire of the other. Mm-hmm. And you can spend your whole life being a rebel because your parents wanted you to be something you didn't, you know, and that can be quite tiresome.
And then it can feel like rebellion is actually a part of your identity when it's actually a response to to some other, some significant other in your life.
So, you know, we work with these ideas, and doing this work, we get to what we call the symptom. So this is another important thing. The symptom is like an essence of yourself. So this rebellious character, and we don't try and cure the symptom or repair the symptom or make it better. What we say in Lacanian work, which I think is very helpful for coaching, is put the symptom to work for yourself and for society. If you do it just for yourself, you can become very selfish. And a lot of life coaching approaches say, you know, you must do what you need. You must love yourself. You must do what you want for yourself. You know, that's part of the story. The other part of finding a good life is to kind of do something for the community, for others. So the Lacanian idea is put your symptom to work. So this person who's kind of found out that they've got a symptom which is rebellious, to carry on the same person, same idea, you know, they can be rebellious and spend their whole life being angry and throwing rocks at kind of the world and you know, and being a sort of an adolescent, angry adolescent throughout their life. Or they can put that to work, and they can kind of put that energy to work to fight for a good cause. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the idea of putting your symptom to work. You know, mm-hmm. So you choose, you know, okay, you know, the world's burning. I'm going to really put my energies to work to kind of make this company zero carbon or something, you know. So you actually put it to work for yourself, and you feel better for yourself because you've got this kind of anger within you and a rebelliousness in you. You're not going to get rid of it, but you can direct it in a good direction.
Yeah, you can lean yourself into it. It's like some people feel they come with a weakness and then often discover, I mean, this is probably my positive psychology lens speaking, but they come in with what they perceived a weakness, and then they realize it's actually a strength that is maybe overdone or utilized in a context that isn't very, very helpful.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So these are some of the ways we work.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned lack, and you talked about what we cannot speak of, and it reminded me about what Lawrence was saying around Jungian perspectives on shadow, what we cannot really speak of. I wonder, what's your perspective on working with shadow? Because we hear that a lot in coaching. Oh, work with a shadow. And I think it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, Lawrence is a colleague and someone I really respect. I'm not a Jungian, and I've never really studied Jung, so I'm not kind of an expert, but interesting. The idea of the shadow I find a bit problematic because it's in commonplace language, it's used as if there's a, for me, it's a bit too binary. It's like we have a good self and a shadow self. And for me, one of the really beauties of psychoanalysis is that it holds in the middle of all this ambivalence and ambiguity. So this conscious and unconscious, not split, they're kind of merged, really. It's kind of a messy, murky merger, you know. So the shadow self is often seen as, you know, you have your idealized self and then you have your kind of your shadow self. And I think these things are more blurred and like that they show up kind of in a much more blurred way than I think that when people think about shadow selves, often they can think about there's like another self, which is like a bad self or a dark self or a troubled self, you know, and the rest of me is okay. And I think this is kind of more messy, entangled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always appreciated that about psychoanalytic approaches. There's, when you dig deeper into them, they can seem like they're pathologizing, but actually, they appreciate the depth of the human psyche and yeah. They normalize a lot of what people don't want to be real, right? We catch ourselves having an insane thought, you know, we catch ourselves having a really dark fantasy or something violent or something that people usually don't speak about. And then, you know, I felt that this is something that is being like, well, this is what's going on in many people's minds, and let's be curious about it and let's explore it and let's see what we can learn from this and how we can make sense of it.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd like to talk about is, you know, I did train, I've moved more towards Lacan, but I did train in the Kleinian object relations, Tavistock, UK kind of British school of object relations theory. And
can you give us a frame for that?
Yeah, I mean, object relations was from the Tavistock, and it was a tradition from sort of Wilfred Bion to Melanie Klein to Wilfred Bion. There's a kind of a heritage, and it carries on there. It's very useful in terms of understanding projections, projective identification, and how things are held by us. So when you were talking then, I was thinking about how when we have a troubled part of ourselves, so when we have if I have a kind of an ego and I'm leaning towards being a messiah leader, you know, I kind of have this sort of charisma and I'm gifted, you know, we know leaders who can get in real trouble with that. It can overtake them. They become very egoistic, or they become kind of tyrants in their own workplaces and stuff, you know. But often we'll project that onto other people and we're blamed on us. So-and-so is a messiah leader, because we can't own it for ourselves. It's too painful to acknowledge that this part of ourselves, you know. So object relations theory says, like, don't project on somebody else, you know, hold that and kind of see what you're carrying for yourself. So we all love to throw rocks at Trump, and we all love to throw rocks at kind of different people. Yeah, sure, there's kind of a badness in the other as well. But think about kind of what you're carrying. What part of yourself identifies with Trump or with a messiah leader or with somebody else, you know? And usually the people who are kind of most angry at kind of the bad other carry some part of themselves of that. So the object relations is really about kind of these emotions which we try and get rid of and project onto other people. And it helps us kind of own some of our own stuff and allows us to work on our own stuff.
Yeah, and I think it's at those moments where I think it can be tempting to start interpreting based on what we know through these kind of theories, right? So if we have a client and they keep talking about this other leader that is very violent or does things that are unacceptable, we can get curious about, you know, you seem to talk about this person quite a lot. You know, I wonder what's there. But yeah. I think this is where sometimes the psychoanalysts get a bad reputation for being like, ah, so you talk about this person a lot, which means that, you know, there's something of this in you. What do you think that's coming from? Is that really the case? How can we avoid it?
Well,
there might be value in interpretation, right? It might be really helpful to put something like this into the space. What do you think?
I think interpretation is very valuable when the analyst or when the coach who's interpreting doesn't do it in a way which is, I'm the expert and I'm saying to you, Yannick, you've got this part of you in you. Yannick, I've observed you doing this. Clearly you're very angry. You know, if I kind of do it in a way which kind of leaves you feeling like the analyst has told you kind of something and you kind of admire me because I'm the analyst, you know, you project onto me that I'm the person. Lacan calls it the one who is supposed to know, the one who is supposed to know. And it's a nice phrase because it's like, you know, the client can often think about the coach as they're such wonderful people, they have such knowledge, you know, and when you say something, it can land like it's a magic word, and you the client can go away and think about this over and over again. Am I really like that? The way you should do an interpretation is collaboratively, in a mutual way. So you deliver it in a way where you suggest something and you say, this is kind of my experience. Do you experience anything similar? And what I find is you get into a dialogue. So I might say, Yannick, I'm feeling kind of a lot of anger off you. Like, you know, is it, you know, and you kind of interpret kind of something. And then you'll get the response and you'll discuss it and you'll end up at a place where actually it's not anger, it's sadness. I can feel that anger was a cover up because actually I'm feeling quite sad about such and such and such. So when you turn it into a dialogue, you know, you allow space for dialogue. It's very different from delivering it as the old fashioned kind of expert psychoanalyst sat behind the patient, giving the interpretation and leaving them with it for two more weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a different way of delivering it. I think it's very useful because it speaks of your experience, but you're always speaking from your experience. You're owning it as a coach. You're not saying like, you know, this is happening to you, Yannick. It's that my experience of this situation is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, do you understand? I believe you understand a lot more about how the psyche works, what's going on for people. The way that you train to listen, you see a lot more, you pick up a lot more. So I wonder what role, if any, does psychoeducation or putting interpretations or information, what you see on the table, what role, if any, does that play in your coaching?
It plays quite a big role, but you have to be sort of strategic about it. You have to remember what your task is. So it's not about offloading your own feelings and stuff. You know, if you do it in service of the task, you know, if the task is to support the client on a journey, then is this going to support the client on the journey? You know, and sometimes sharing can be hugely important for them. They feel you're more authentic. They kind of they know that you're understanding them. It's a way of communicating your understanding of their situation and things. You know, other times it can be kind of dumping on them. You know, so you have to really kind of think about like, is this in service of the task? Is this going to be useful to the client? Mm-hmm. And then I think it can be useful. And I share quite a lot, but there's something I don't share. There's a lot I don't share, a huge amount I don't share as well, you know. But when I feel it's appropriate to kind of show empathy, demonstrate empathy or some deeper level of communication, it can be important.
Yeah, it seems to me that contracting plays a big role in this kind of working because as I imagine, using a psychoanalytic approach to work with someone in an organization, I thought like, well, yes, if you start, what is your desire? That's kind of a light way to invite someone into a bit of a different conversation. But sharing something like that or sharing interpretation or opening a door into something that could potentially be quite dark or very emotional or, you know, really opening a door. Clients need to be on board with that, right? So how do you set up the space so that your clients are prepared for what may come?
I mean, I'm explicit about kind of where I come from. So I usually tell people, you know, previously I've been a therapist and I might work in a certain, I might kind of explore things around your family. If you feel uncomfortable at any time, let me know. You know, I set out, you know, I was trained in psychoanalysis. I set out kind of who I am. Mm-hmm. But really, I think it's about being sensitive to a person. And there's some clients I work with and we don't go very deep at all because they don't want to go deep. They, you know, I always say that I train my coaches to kind of to open the door, but you're not pushing people through. You know, I'll hold the door open, but the client doesn't want to go through the door. You know, I mean, I'll be challenging and I kind of like provoke a bit, and we'll find out kind of you know, clearly some people kind of need a nudge or an interpretation to help them, but a client who really doesn't want to go there, really doesn't want to work there. And that's fine. And like, you know, as psychoanalysts, we know that the more you push, the more kind of resistance you get. So you know, you don't do it anyway. So it's kind of a way of working, which is very sensitive and empathetic to others, you know. So you're not kind of suddenly jumping on someone and giving them an interpretation about their life, you know. You're sharing, you know, you're gradually sharing a bit about yourself. You're opening up a space and you see where they go. And the client is really leading it. It's kind of you're holding up. I mean, I think another concept we should talk about is containment, the idea of containment, which is very important in psychoanalysis. And containment I wrote my first master's thesis at the Tavistock on containment, and we talked about maternal and paternal containment. At the Tavistock, they talk a lot about maternal containment, and it goes back to studying the infant. This is done in the 1950s, 60s, where gender roles were much more clear. So you could talk about the mother and the baby. It was a much more kind of genderized society, the way people thought about parenting children. That's where the language comes from. You can also think about it in terms of emotional containment and structural containment. So for me, when you're working with a client, you have to have a contained space to work. And that means clear enough contracting, understanding the fees, having a room you could work in with no interruption, creating kind of a safe space, all the kind of structural things you need to create a safe space. So when you're working with a client, you can actually do some work. When you do the work with a client, you then need to kind of hold an emotional containing space. And that means kind of creating a safe space so the client can actually speak into that space at whatever level they want. You're not pushing them into some deep level, but you're holding a space which is more than a psychological space. It's your body is a container and the client is a contained, and they can safely explore their emotions, safely explore some of their concerns, safely explore what they want to explore, knowing that you're going to hold that emotional, and you're not going to fall apart, you're not going to get angry, you're not going to be reactive, you're going to be a solid person. And this is a very unusual thing for people. This is actually, you know, in our relationships with others, everyone's busy, everyone's got their own stuff going on. There's not very often you come across these spaces. So these spaces are very important. So you create this containment. And then at the end of the session, one of the differences between psychoanalysis and coaching is that's what you do in psychoanalysis. You hold that space, and you can hold it for 5 years. You can hold it over a long period of time. People do some very, very deep work. In coaching, there's a return to the structural. You have to go back into the world. So you leave the coaching session and you have to go back to work, and you have to kind of and the coaching is usually orientated around helping the person make some change. Mm-hmm. And rather than just kind of psychoanalysis is about giving people insights and then they do what they want with those insights. But coaching is usually supporting them to deliver some change, particularly workplace coaching, which I do. So I'm tasked to help the person do something back in the workplace, whether it's develop a better strategy, be a better team performer, to kind of, and it's that. So the coaching session goes from structural, emotional, back to structural, and then thinks, how can you make a change back in your workplace? How can you use what experiences you've had to make a change back in the workplace? And we go through this sort of this journey with clients, and this idea of containment is really important part of that understanding. And I think coaches are quite weak at that. I don't think psychoanalysis is very strong about that. They know about the 50-minute hour. They know about creating a very safe space. They know about emotional containment. They don't usually do the last piece, which is make a difference in their life. But they understand that containment piece, and it's very important the way I work. And I think coaches could learn quite a lot more about that.
Yeah, and that's you know, often there's this. I hear coaches talk very badly about like the 50 minutes are up or the session is up, and the stereotypical therapist who just says that's all the time we have, and creating a really strong boundary at the time. That containment, that's exactly why that is being done, so that there's safety in boundaries and in the contract, in the space, in the agreement that we're creating, and that is not going to be pushed, because whenever you push a boundary, it creates uncertainty and it creates less psychological safety.
That's right. And I in coaching, it's not the same as analysis. So there is more, mm-hmm. more given that. And in the Lacanian way of working, you actually don't have a 50-minute hour. You have a variable session. Lacan was an incredibly interesting person, incredibly difficult to read. I wouldn't suggest anyone tries to read Lacan unless they're really going to commit 5 years or 10 years of their life to it. But he also kind of was a provocateur and experimented, and he had this variable session. So you can be in a psychoanalytic session with Lacan, and he would cut it after 30 minutes.
Oh, Scansion.
Yeah, Lacan.
Yeah. Lacan. Yeah, my wife was telling me about that. At some point, that's just like, no explanation, no interpretation. Just, I think we should stop here.
That's right. And it's really interesting. I mean, I worked with one of the world's leading psychoanalysts. He lives in he's the head of the World Association of Psychoanalysts and the Kenyan. His name is Jacques Alain Miller. And I used to go to Paris and get analyzed by him. And it was just, this is my first experience of this. And it's like, you just say, go.
Oh, wow.
And I'd go, but it was absolutely brilliant because you go, and then I'd see him later on in the day as well. And I'd wander the parks of Paris and he'd leave you with something.
Oh, he said, go for you to go rather than go ahead tell me. Okay.
I entered the session, he'd say, tell me. That was his first word, tell me. And then he'd do a cut and he'd like, after 20 minutes or 40, 30 minutes, he'd say, go. And you go walk the parks of Paris, but you'd be left with something. He'd cut it at a moment which would kind of, and you'd be doing the work, you'd be doing the process. And then I'd see him again later in the day and we'd start again. And just very, very interesting.
Yes, it seems very harsh, I believe, when I'm putting myself into the shoes of a listener. But it's really very powerful. I've seen my wife come out of a session and she's just like, she was deep thought, you know? And it was one of those moments where it just got cut and it really moved something. So I think if that's done skillfully, I think it gives the analysts maybe some kind of power, but it's an invitation and they're not offering you the invitation or the interpretation, but it's an invitation to, there's something there. And I think taking that role as a coach or an analyst is a very powerful thing to do,
And, I use it in coaching and I don't say go. I don't kind of suddenly send someone out of the room. I do stop a conversation, and I say, can we just stop there for a second? Let's think about, what's been happening here? What do you think has been happening here? And I put it back to them and I do a similar thing, but without sending them out of the room, what's really going on at the moment for you? And it's really quite powerful. Yeah.
There was a question I wanted to ask earlier when you described that some clients don't want to go to that kind of level and you can invite them and they might not go there. I hear that in supervision quite a lot, that frustration that a client doesn't want to go deeper, and the more you invite them, the more their defenses go up. How do you navigate that in practice?
I don't think you can escape deep experience. One other thing to say is to learn psychoanalysis, you don't learn it from books, really. You learn it through undergoing psychoanalysis yourself. You undergo through lots of supervision, it really is... I'm talking to my friend David Rothser, who's on your show before, and he shares an idea of transmission, and we both talk about kind of it's a way of learning coaching and psychoanalysis through transmission. So you get this kind of idea of transmission, and that's kind of a way of learning, and you can't shortcut that. So when I'm with a client, there's two examples. One client I was with, I remember. And he was just really highly defended. He really didn't want to go back to any early stuff, And I had to respect that. It's like, I tried to open up every door and open doors, and I tried everything in my without kind of pushing him too much. And I realized he's probably been sent here rather than chose to come here, for coaching. And he's just not in a place yet where he's ready to do the work. And I respected that. I had another client who I was working with, and they kept on coming back, and it was really frustrating for them and for us. The client kept on saying, I want to work on my career. And I was like picking up something like, you don't want to work on your career. You want to work on something else. There's something really strong being like, and I was sharing this and expressing it. No, I want to just work on my career. That's all I said. There's something else going on, isn't there? And we talk about this, and then they go away and they come back. So, I was learning that, they're coming back for something, because I'm not answering their question. I said, if you want a career coach or career counselor, I can get you one. That's not me. We can find someone else for that role. I can be supportive, or we can do some other work. It took, I can't remember, 3 months or something. And it was about a very deep personal issue, which we worked on, which was in the end transformational, very scary for the client, had to kind of build up enough trust. We worked on, But I just held a solid chair and I stayed with it and I stayed with it and I stayed with it and I wouldn't, you know, and they came back and came back and came back and we did that work, you know. So it's really about kind of the experience of knowing when to kind of say, okay, this is not going to happen, or we really, you know, the best thing I do is stay with this client and hold them and it will happen in their own time.
Yeah, I remember reading Irvin Yalom, and it loved, amazing writer, just, and he tells stories from his therapy room. And I remember vividly reading about some of these stories where he just kind of summarizes 3, 5, 6 months of work in a sentence where he's just holding space, you know, just be there with that person for them to go through whatever they need to go through. And I read that and I thought, I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't just want to wait until they come around, you know, but I also know that if I were to be more active, it's probably not helpful because they, you know, sometimes they need to, you need to build a relationship. You need to continuously show up until somebody builds the kind of trust to really open up something like that, something that is maybe they haven't shared ever before, something there might be a lot of shame involved. So as a coach, I always wonder, how long is ethical for me to just sit there when, you know, it's a big investment, right? Coaching is usually a lot more expensive than psychoanalysis is.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, you have to be led by your experience, by the client, you know, like, so, like with some clients, I say, you know, this isn't working. And I suggest that, you know, sometimes I say, like, you know, I don't think I'm the right coach for you. I think you need someone far more performance focused. That's not really my greatest skill set. And so, you know, we can find, I think I know someone who could be good, or you might want a career coach, or, you know, I think you're actually getting into therapeutic territory. I could suggest a therapist. I think this would be longer term work, you know? So I think holding that, you know, but if the client says, no, I want to work with you, Simon, and they want to, you know, and then they start building that trust. And then I listen to that as well, you know, and that can happen. So I think it's about holding those options up, really, and making sure you're not kind of just colluding and doing nothing for 6 months, but you are saying, like, you know, there's these different avenues, but if you want to carry on working, let's do the work.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not that you're doing nothing, you're actually doing a lot. You're constantly making yourself not to interrupt or accelerate or intervene, because, you know, it's important to hold space. Holding space, doing nothing in speech marks, you know, it's never nothing. There's so much.
It's a lot of work, actually. You're right.
And really good to hear you phrase how you might suggest someone working with someone else, because I think there's an art in these kind of referrals to not make it sound like you're abandoning someone, or you are sending them away because they're too broken, or they're, you know, not good enough. But it's really everything that you've said was in the best interest of the client, finding the right person to work with.
Yeah. And it's nice to do that as well, because it kind of gets rid of an omnipotence of the coach. You know, that I'm the one who can heal. I can work with you. I'm the best coach. You know, even by sharing it, you're saying, like, you know, I'm human as well, and I'm kind of you know, I'm not skilled at everything. You know, we all have our limitations, and it kind of models for the client, kind of like they don't have to be perfect either. You know.
Yeah, makes sense. I had another question on here that I wanted to ask, which is what might be some other misconceptions that people have about psychoanalytic approaches or a psychoanalytic way of coaching that you hear?
I think, you know, I'm not going to defend psychoanalysis completely, because I think it does get itself into trouble. You know, I think in the past it has been too elitist. It's been kind of... The psychoanalyst has taken on a role of being the one who knows everything. You know, that it's got itself into some, it can be too pathologizing. It can only look at kind of what one side. So, you know, there is challenges within psychoanalysis, but I think people need to let go of the ideas of some sort of traditional 1950s idea of a very stern psychoanalyst. You know, the way we're working is for me, the unconscious is present whether you kind of like it or not. It's there.
Yeah. You know? Whether you pay attention to it or not.
You either pay attention to it and you learn to work with it or not. And I'm not saying every coach should, but if you choose to, it's a very, very powerful way to work and very useful way to work. And it develops a curiosity. It develops kind of a curiosity about kind of what we don't know. You have to, you know, one of the strengths of psychoanalysis is it says that we all have to kind of work with the unknown a bit. We all have to kind of hold on to the fact that we don't know everything, and there's not an answer to everything, and not a quick solution to everything, you know. But life is really about kind of working kind of through things, holding different emotions. I think a great strength of it, of psychoanalysis, is also to understand that the emotions are powerful, not just as a psychological kind of mechanism. You know, some coaching ideas or sort of CBT kind of thinking about how we can kind of change cognitive ways of thinking. It's so embedded in, like, you know, life is about love, loss, grief, happiness, joy, hope, desire. We're desiring subjects, you know, we all have very strong desires, you know. So psychoanalysis kind of names those things and holds those things as sort of a primary kind of a facet of humanity. And that's the stuff we work with. And I think that's important in any coaching relationship. How much you bring it in is variable, but having the capacity to work with that kind of rich human stuff is important.
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, we're nearly at the end. One thing I was curious about, maybe it's more personal, maybe there's something else in there, but I noticed that some of your positions that you have, just kind of looking at your most recent bio compared to a number of years ago, you were very involved in psychoanalytic institutions and psychoanalytic study, you know, psychoanalytic study in organizations. You were teaching quite a lot of that. You seem to have left some of that behind. I'm wondering what you're up to these days and what's changed, if anything.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, what changed is that the psychoanalytic institutions, the way of thinking, I started to get frustrated with. I did find it a bit pathologizing. I did find it a bit repetitive. I did find it. I mean, I'm still in the ISPSL, the International Society. I'm still a member, which I find very valuable. I enjoy being part of. I attend Lacanian lectures and talks in Dublin. So I'm still involved. It's still a very important part of my work. We're about to launch a psychoanalytic course next year. David and I are gonna do that coaching course. So look out for that. So it's still a big part, but what's really changed for me is the Eco Leadership Institute. So psychoanalysis has always been a part of what I do. And I believe in creating the good self and trying to kind of develop a good life and trying to put that to work for a good society. And the Eco Leadership Institute is kind of my main work at the moment. So I'm really focused on leadership, on eco-leadership, on how we develop kind of healthy organizations which are ethical and driven. So I'm spending a lot of time working with Save the Children Fund and the humanitarian world at the moment. I've just come back from Poland, working with Ukrainian NGOs, supporting them in their work. So a lot of my work is focused on developing the Eco-Leadership Institute, and really trying to change organizations so that they can kind of help the world become a better place. Because for me, like, politics is too far away, but organizations are a massive part of a society. And if we can start making changes in organizations and change the way we think, and my psychoanalysis plays a part of that, and my coaching plays a part of that. But that's my kind of focus at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's challenging enough and complex enough when you work with an individual, and an individual is never just an individual. We're always linked with all of these nested systems that we're in. But when you start working with a whole organization, I mean, what is an organization but people coming together? But then there's more than just the individual parts to the whole. Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating work.
It is, and I'm really enjoying it. And it's like, it's powerful work. It's fascinating, and it's very rich, and I just think hugely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a whole nother podcast, I feel. We'll have you back. I have a feeling that we might. Simon, thank you so much. Anything else that you would want coaches out there to maybe consider or reflect on in the context of what we just talked about?
Really not to be afraid of the unconscious. I mean, really to embrace it and just to start to look for it in your life. I mean, for me, when I started to pay attention to the unconscious and learn more about it, life became much more interesting. it opens up a kind of another world, and rather than being defensive about it and saying it, you know, but look at it in your clients, look for it in your own life, and it starts to develop a curiosity, and I think that curiosity can only be helpful in your work. So that's a starting place. So Yannick, it's been really lovely talking to you as well. So thank you so much for a lovely interview.
Thank you, Simon. See you soon.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To watch these episodes on video, make sure you also check out youtube.com/animascoaching. See you back here soon.